Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. President Obama has set his sights on the terrorist group known as ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. In a speech last night, the president outlined his intention to lead a broad coalition to degrade and ultimately destroy the terrorist group responsible for multiple atrocities abroad, including brutality against citizens in the areas it controls and the videotaped murderers of two American journalists. So how does this effort, which the president insists will not include the deployment of U.S. ground combat troops, play into the grand strategy of the Obama administration? And what effects might it have on existing plans for support of Ukrainian sovereignty and a long-discussed pivot of America's foreign policy emphasis toward Asia? Joshua Rovner is John G. Tower, Distinguished Professor of International Politics and National Security at SMU. Hal Brands is Assistant Professor of Public Policy and History at Duke University and author of the new book, What Good is Grand Strategy? Power and Purpose in American Statecraft from Harry S. Truman to George W. Bush. Both will be taking part in a panel discussion this evening at 5:30 at Prothrow Hall on the SMU campus, titled After Al-Qaeda, the Future of American Grand Strategy. Welcome both of you to Think.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Good to be back.
So we'll jump to current events very shortly, but let's start off, Hal, with some overarching understanding. Will you define the term grand strategy for us and what it sets out to do?
Sure. A grand strategy is basically a country's big picture conceptual logic of what it's trying to accomplish in the world and how it actually wants to get there. And so it involves judgments about things like, what does the international environment look like? What are our major goals and interests? What are the major threats to those interests? And then how do we use the resources that we have to actually deal with threats and opportunities? And if you really have a grand strategy, these judgments don't just exist in a vacuum. They're actually driving policy on a day-to-day basis. So I like to think of a grand strategy as basically the theory or the logic that connects a country's highest interest to its day-to-day interactions with the world.
So essentially, you're taking away the silos from different kinds of decisions that affect foreign policy in different ways?
Exactly. A grand strategy should be something that integrates your interests over various parts of the world and various aspects of foreign policy and hopefully brings them together into a coherent whole.
So that sounds necessary and important. Josh, what are the big impediments to getting this right? Why is this so challenging for us and other countries as well?
Well, grand strategy is difficult for a number of reasons. One, it's hard to understand exactly how the world works. There's a lot of confusion in the world. There's a lot of uncertain information. Understanding what are real threats and what are illusory threats is very difficult. And then there's just the big problem of organizing the vast U.S. national security bureaucracy. And this is it's enormous. There's a huge number of agencies involved and people involved. And getting them to move in the same direction can be very, very demanding.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking last night, listening to the speech, that there was a lot of information to process to make the decision that, for example, we will not send ground troops, we will lead an international coalition. To what extent did that address by President Obama reflect the grand strategy of his administration?
Well, I think that it does reflect some of the underlying tensions within the White House right now. I think clearly the White House would prefer to rebalance to Asia. That seems to be its main priority, and try to reduce its presence in the Middle East. On the other hand, there is a strain of thought within the White House that says we need to stay in the Middle East. We have an enduring commitment to the stability and security of this region. So when we see something like ISIS pop up, we can't do nothing. So I think that the president himself is trying to balance between the desire to look at rising China and the pivot to Asia. But on the other hand, he's trying to respond to what is clearly a very ruthless group in Iraq and Syria.
I would just add that I think you can very much see that in the obvious ambivalence to the president's decision to first go back into Iraq militarily about a month ago with airstrikes and now potentially to expand that campaign to Syria. This is not where President Obama sees America's interests going over the long term. He's much more interested in pivoting to what he thinks, I think correctly, is going to be the cockpit of 21st century geopolitics and economic dynamism in the Far East. The trouble is that pivoting away from the Middle East has turned out to be much more difficult than I think the administration first intended. And so what you're seeing now, as Josh pointed out, is that they are trying to maintain a basic level and stability in the Middle East without prejudicing the long-term ability to focus on other things.
Well, focusing in these areas obviously is not mutually exclusive, but it does seem that the president has been quite frustrated multiple times trying to sort of be done in the Middle East, and each time something pops up that frustrates that.
I think some context is important. If you look back about 5 years ago, there were something like 230,000 American personnel in the Persian Gulf region itself. Today, there are fewer than 50,000 personnel. So the president, despite the frustrations, despite the ongoing turmoil and the desire to do something about these problems, has managed to remove most of American combat power from that region. And even some escalation to go back into Iraq and Syria is not going to get us back where we were in sort of the latter part of the last decade. So, again, I agree with Hal that the administration would like to rebalance in earnest to Asia. But even the frustration of not being able to exit completely doesn't necessarily make that impossible.
And I would add to that this intervention is very much in the same vein as other Obama administration military interventions. If you look back at Libya in 2011, this is going to be a light footprint approach to the extent that ground forces are being brought to bear against ISIS. They're not going to be American troops. They're going to be Kurdish Peshmerga. They're going to be Iraqi army. We're basically going to be providing air power and various intelligence and other sorts of enabling support. But I think that the president is very much determined that this not become something on the scale of another Iraq or another Afghanistan.
Is it reasonable to ask whether we perhaps left too soon and could have prevented this flare-up?
I think it's a great question. I've argued publicly that we didn't leave too soon. I think that most of what's going on the ground is based on local politics and local grievances. I think that had the United States stayed in earnest in Iraq after 2011, at best, it could have inhibited ISIS a little bit. It could have slowed its approach from the Syrian border, but it wouldn't have eliminated the underlying problem. So I argued at the time, and I continue to believe, that getting out of Iraq was the right call in 2011. Now, I understand that people like Senator John McCain are saying, no, we really needed to stay in Iraq, and we should have helped the Syrian opposition a lot sooner, or this would have never happened. I'm deeply skeptical of that argument. I think that what that really means is getting further involved in the Syrian civil war, right, which is, frankly, more complicated than we're ready to handle.
I'm a little bit more critical of the haste in getting out of Iraq in 2011. I certainly agree that there are real questions unanswered about whether a status of forces agreement with the Iraqi government that would have legally allowed us to keep our troops in Iraq after 2011, there are some of those questions that remain unresolved. I think what the value of a presence of about 10 or 15,000 American troops would have had was, one, shoring up the Iraqi army to some extent, and then, two, perhaps helping to take some of the rougher edges off Nouri al-Maliki's governing style, which had been, I think, a pretty major effect of the American presence from 2007 to 2011 when we left. And once we left, I think those rough edges came out in a much stronger way. In a way that alienated quite a number of people elsewhere on the Iraqi political spectrum.
If I could just jump in very quickly on that. I don't think that we could have controlled Maliki's behavior because I this is a civil war. This is a very vicious, ruthless, brutal, ethnic and sectarian civil war. And the people that fight for power in those kind of wars, like Nouri al-Maliki, are not nice, moderate people. Right? They're power hungry. They're very violent. They're very willing to do things which offend us. So whether or not we were there or not really wasn't going to change Maliki's point of view. He was increasingly brutal and power hungry when we were there, and he was brutal and power hungry after we left. Right. So if we stop thinking about these conflicts as sort of nation building exercises in order to impart our values and as very nasty, bloody civil wars, our whole perspective changes. And to me, at least, it limits what we can hope to accomplish in them.
I would not one bit dispute Josh's characterization of Maliki. What I would argue is that I think you can make a credible argument that U.S. forces provided a sort of shock absorber while they were there. And then it's not a question of whether keeping our forces there in a smaller number would have turned Maliki into a Jeffersonian Democrat. It's a question of whether they would have provided just enough of a marginal improvement so that we would have seen less of a catastrophic deterioration of the situation.
How significant is the timing of last night's speech just days after al-Maliki left and we have a new prime minister?
I think that's absolutely it. I think the timing is very significant. Since June, when the ISIS issue really first popped onto the radar screen of most Americans, the Obama administration has been very consistent in saying we are happy to help. We have an interest in not seeing ISIS overrun vast parts of Iraq, but we're not going to do it until there is a somewhat more inclusive political setting in Baghdad. And what they mean by more inclusive is, again, not some sort of Mesopotamian Switzerland. What they mean is that there is going to be a leader who doesn't seem to go out of his way to alienate other power blocks in Iraqi society. We saw movement on that about a month ago, and now that the new government has actually been more or less formed, I think that explains quite a lot about why the administration is willing to go forward more energetically over the past few weeks.
Two quick points on that. One, we are always looking for the responsible moderate. When we intervene in conflicts like that, we're forever pinning on our hopes on somebody who we believe won't alienate other groups or behave badly. And very often we're disappointed. And the reasons we're disappointed, again, is that these are wars that attract the kind of people that we don't want in power, to power. Right. So I agree that we would love to see people who are more responsible than Maliki, but I'm not at all surprised that somebody like Maliki would end up in charge and consolidating power. And I'm very skeptical that the next guy will be any nicer than the old guy. Right. So, again, I'm very nervous about that.
Well, I mean, look at this country, and of course we don't have sectarian violence and things are, you know, handled peacefully and democratically, but it's not as if, you know, we're looking for the responsible moderate to lead this country in Congress and the White House. People are constantly disappointed. I mean, is there any reason to think that leaders in any other part of the world are going to somehow have a more inclusive approach to governance than we have in this country?
I think there's a very real chance that our expectations will get far ahead of what's possible. But again, I think it's important to remember that what we're trying to do in Iraq is the same thing that we've tried to do in previous civil war contexts, whether in El Salvador in the 1980s or elsewhere. We're not looking for the perfect moderate responsible leader. We're looking for just enough marginal improvement to improve the situation. I think that may actually be possible, although I fully share Josh's concerns about how the structure of the Iraqi political system and the nature of political conflict in that country may complicate this over the long term.
One quick point on that. I'm glad you brought up the American experience, because people often talk about the U.S. experience. Our own nation-building project was incredibly bloody, and it took forever. Right? It took 80 years to get to the Civil War until we were willing to deal forthrightly with our basic underlying problems. And then it took another century of Reconstruction in the Civil Rights Movement. That's not a really optimistic precedent for a place like Iraq or Syria, these deeply riven societies. So I think we should be very cautious about this.
All right. Let's talk about our allies in this international coalition. The British have pledged like 1,000 troops to assist with the coalition campaign. How much support can we assume we will have from the allies who went with us the first time?
Well, I think that you're going to get some support from the British. You'll get some support from other European countries. They've expressed concern that some of their own citizens have traveled to Syria and Iraq, so they have an interest in at least keeping tabs on them, if not trying to get to some better solution in the Middle East. But I think the important allies are going to be the ones on the ground. Right? The truly important players in this contest are the Syrian government, the Free Syrian Army. This is the other coalition of opposition groups. Iran, the government in Baghdad, and the Kurds. All of those groups have an enormous stake in ISIS, a much bigger stake than the Europeans have, and certainly a much bigger stake than we have. So it's their decisions that are going to ultimately determine the outcome of this, not really the international coalition's decisions.
We're speaking this hour with Joshua Roebner, who is John G. Tower Distinguished Professor of International Politics and National Security at SMU, and Hal Brands, Assistant Professor of Public Policy and History at Duke University, also author of the new book, What Good is Grand Strategy? Power and Purpose in American Statecraft, from Harry S. Truman to George W. Bush. Both will take part in a panel discussion this evening at SMU entitled After Al-Qaeda, The Future of American Grand Strategy. If you want to join our conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Hal Brands, who is Assistant Professor of Public Policy and History at Duke University and author of What Good is Grand Strategy? Power and Purpose in American Statecraft from Harry S. Truman to George W. Bush, and with Joshua Rovner, John G. Tower Distinguished Professor of International Politics and National Security at SMU. Both are taking part this evening at SMU in a panel discussion titled After Al-Qaeda, the Future of American Grand Strategy. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Sort of a technical question here from Christina, but one I think worth addressing. She asks, why are the acronyms ISIS and ISIL used interchangeably?
It's a good question. The fact is that the group calls itself one thing. It used to call itself something else, and most other people call it something different. So right now, the group calls itself the Islamic State, reflecting the fact that it has pretensions to be a state that will essentially redraw the borders of the Middle East, particularly in Iraq and Syria. Most American officials refer to it either as ISIL or ISIS, reflecting the fact that this is what it was formerly known as. But they are all the same group. It's simply a set of different acronyms for talking about it.
The president went to great pains last night to reiterate to the American public that, of course, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria is not a state. It is not recognized internationally. It is a terrorist group. Estimates are, and I know these are notoriously slippery, though, that there's a fighting force of 10,000 men. How does that compare with al-Qaeda at its height? And what does that mean for the kind of strategy we would take on, even in these air campaigns, looking to take out significant targets?
Well, one thing, the figures are very, very hard to pin down. And, you know, even people who are sort of in the know are using very general estimates on the total size. But the important factor is that it is comparatively large versus other terrorist groups. There's no doubt about that. It's probably the most competent group since al-Qaeda in the 1990s. And the implications of that cause us to ask some pretty fundamental questions. Right? Al-Qaeda in the 1990s was a very unique terrorist group. It was large. It was well-organized. It had global reach. It was well-financed. And it had huge and terrifying ambitions. Some people are comparing ISIS to al-Qaeda. Right? This is the new iteration of that kind of group. They will say, most terrorist groups, we can safely ignore them or deal with them in other ways, but not a group like this. The question is that group really like al-Qaeda or not? Because there are important differences in what's going on. Al-Qaeda in the 1990s did have a friendly government providing sanctuary. It was removed from American air power by and large during the 1990s, an American force. ISIS right now is surrounded by people that hate it, from the Syrians to the Kurds to the Iranians to the Shia in the south of Baghdad, right? So it despite its size and despite its wealth, it does have this very serious problem that it is essentially boxed in by people who would like to see it gone.
Yeah, what makes ISIS so scary to people in the national security community is that it actually looks something like an actual army. So it is comparatively large relative to most other terrorist organizations, and it's actually shown an ability to form up and move in columns of vehicles across northern Iraq and to do things that you usually don't associate with terrorist groups. Now, that may also be a vulnerability for them. The more conventional you are, the easier it is for a country like the United States to target you from the air. And so if ISIS wants to hold territory, if they want to move relatively large numbers of troops and vehicles or through other means across Iraq or into Syria, that just makes it easier for us to spot them from the air and to hit them with U.S. air power.
It's sort of like the difference between a startup company and the sort of culture that you have there and the nimbleness that exists and then one that starts to get large. Is that?
No, I think the analogy is right. I mean, size has its advantages and it has its disadvantages. And the disadvantages, one that Hal mentioned, is that you become a very attractive target. The more that you organize, the more that you expose yourself to fire, the more that you're going to get hit. The other big disadvantage is that once that you control all of this space and declare that you are a state, well, you're responsible for administering that state. Right? So for all of the revenue that ISIS is generating through oil and smuggling and so forth, they have to spend a lot of that on just basic services, right? So that the people they are ruling won't simply turn against them at the first opportunity. So that there is a distinction there. The other analogy which is worth thinking about is to ask whether or not ISIS looks like al-Qaeda in the 1990s, which I do think was unique and terrifying, versus the Taliban in the 1990s, which was a local group that was focused primarily on local issues. Morally odious, terrible, terrible regime, but not a direct threat to the United States. So if we decide that ISIS today looks like the Taliban, we don't have to like them, but we don't necessarily have to go to war with them. On the other hand, if we decide that ISIS looks like al-Qaeda, then I can see a logic for action.
I would just add that the analogy that was just laid out is not one that I think is particularly comforting to most U.S. policymakers. So even if ISIS is the Taliban in the 1990s, or like the Taliban was in the 1990s, I think there's a pretty pervasive feeling in a lot of the national security establishment in the United States that we've seen this movie before, and we've seen what happens when you allow a radical Islamist group to govern territory, and the outcome is not good. Now, that reading may be wrong in this case, but I think that explains a lot of the very striking language you've seen coming out of the Department of Defense, coming out of the Department of State, about why ISIS is a serious threat that needs to be confronted.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Daniel on the line in Dallas. Hey, Daniel.
Hi there. Two brief questions for your guests. First, why would we expect Syrian rebels who are trying to overthrow the Assad regime to then go and fight ISIS for us? Seems I realize that ISIS is also a threat to them, but it seems not their primary concern. And second, given the geographical area that ISIS occupies, is it possible to form a blockade around them so that no one in that territory can escape?
Thanks for your call.
Sure. I'll take a crack at it first. One, I don't count on the Free Syrian Army to do all that well against ISIS. The Free Syrian Army is this hodgepodge of many different groups who have never been very well coordinated. A lot of these groups are basically organized at the village level. There are at least dozens of these groups, and probably many more than that, depending on how you count the differences. They've never achieved anything like unity among themselves. And it turns out that the only groups in Syria that have achieved something like unity, something like a national presence, are the Islamist groups, like ISIS, right? So the groups that we would like to fight on our behalf have not been able to coordinate actions. And I think that the caller is correct. The caller is right that their primary mission is getting rid of Assad. Right? They worry about ISIS, they fight against ISIS, but their main enemy is Bashar al-Assad.
I would agree. I think that the FSA is in many ways the weak leg of the stool of American strategy in taking on ISIS. And they are not a terribly effective fighting force, and frankly, they're not terribly motivated compared to a number of the more Islamist groups in Syria. So are they a very effective fighting force now? No. Could they become somewhat more effective with American and other support? Perhaps. And that's what we're about to see. With respect to the second part of the question, can we essentially blockade the Islamic State or the territory that the Islamic State controls? A land blockade is going to be very difficult to enforce. One of the things we've seen is that the borders in the Middle East are notoriously porous. And so it's not necessarily more realistic to think that we could simply seal off the territory that ISIS has now than to think that borders would contain them in the first place. The other problem is that there are a lot of non-ISIS people within the area that ISIS controls. And so if you are really sealing off those territories, then you are potentially preventing innocent people from fleeing those areas if they want to.
Yeah, just to follow on that, I agree that something like an airtight blockade probably is impossible, but something looser, a looser kind of containment, I think is possible. Not just because of the geography of where ISIS is located, but because of the fact that they're surrounded by enemies. Now, what places do we really want to keep ISIS out of is the question, right? And the main one to me is the south of Iraq, where the majority of Iraqi oil is located, right? And the closer you get to the south of Iraq and the closer you get to the oil fields, the more that a direct American interest comes into stake, and the closer you get to Saudi Arabia, where there's a great deal more oil. Can we prevent the movement of ISIS to those areas? I think yes. I think there's a lot of reasons that the Shia in the south of Iraq can do it, and we can help them a little bit.
I would simply add one area to the list that Josh has provided, which is we would like to keep them from overrunning Kurdish areas in Iraq as well, for a couple of reasons. One is because the Kurdish administered areas in Iraq have sort of been an island of relatively good governance in the Middle East over the past couple of decades. The Kurds are pretty committed American allies, and they are pretty good fighters as well. The other thing is that I think the United States actually does have sort of a moral debt to the Kurds, given what happened in the 1970s and the 1980s and the 1990s and the long history of the way that they have been in many ways used and then discarded by a long number of outside powers, including the United States. And so I don't think that the moral concern should determine everything, but I think it is important to keep in mind here.
All right, I'd like to pivot this discussion, like the Obama administration, not yet to Asia, but I want to talk a bit about Russia and Ukraine. And of course, this came up briefly last night in the address. First of all, what can we make of the apparent relative success of the ongoing ceasefire and the fact that, in fact, there were some slips early on? And my understanding is that some Russian commanders said it must have been a mistake. Maybe the Ukrainian side had not heard that there was a ceasefire going on against the other side.
I think what we can make of it is that the Russian-backed rebels have essentially consolidated their position in eastern Ukraine. So 2 to 3 weeks ago, it looked like those forces were on their way to being crushed by the Ukrainian military. The Russian military, by all indications, intervened, and the situation has been flipped considerably. Yes, we have a ceasefire that seems to be holding. There's no longer the same amount of violence, although there have been incidents of shelling. But I think that simply reflects the fact that there's a status quo that the Russians and the Ukrainian rebels can live with right now. And I think the Ukrainian government has become increasingly resigned to the fact that they're not going to be able to retake eastern Ukraine by force.
There are Russia watchers often talk about this notion of a frozen conflict. And what they'll say is that Vladimir Putin is trying to do something in Ukraine, as he's done elsewhere along the Russian periphery, which is create a situation of sort of instability and stasis. Mm-hmm. Right? So you've this ongoing tension, this ongoing sort of low-level potential for violence and instability. And in that way, he's able to keep Russian influence in these countries. And you might be seeing some of that right now with this ceasefire. I think that Hal's right. I think that Russia is satisfied that they've restored the separatists to their positions, and they feel fairly confident that they can hold them. So at this point, they can say, let's do a ceasefire.
What options besides economic sanctions does the Obama administration have at this point?
If the goal is to get Russia out of Crimea or even to reverse the gains of the separatists in Ukraine, the options are basically nil. I think there's very little that we can do. You could potentially provide more in the way of military aid to the Ukrainian armed forces, but I think what we've seen in the past 2 to 3 weeks is that Russia is willing to use as much force as is necessary to prevent the rebels from being defeated. There are other questions about what we could do looking beyond Ukraine, if you're looking at sort of the broader area of Eastern Europe. But I think our options are actually quite limited if going beyond economic sanctions in Ukraine.
Yeah, I think that the thing that we have to remember is that Ukraine is vastly more important to Russia than it is to us. Right? So even though we have sort of lit our hair on fire about opposing Putin's actions, frankly, it matters so much more to him than it does to us that he's willing to pay a great deal of cost to at least reestablish some Russian influence. Now, I don't think that Vladimir Putin is a very good strategist. I think he's made huge mistakes. I think he's paying an enormous cost for this. The Russian economy is in deep turmoil because of this. The Russian security situation in one way is getting worse, not better, because he's breathed new life into NATO. But he appears willing to pay these costs in order to stake the Russian claim in Ukraine. And I think that we need to come to grips with that at some point.
So there will be no drawing a line in the sand on the part of the United States?
Oh, I don't think so. I think it's quite clear from the Obama administration, even critics of the Obama administration recognize that the balance of interest is totally unequal.
There has been a drawing of a line in the sand, except that line is not in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So Obama just went to the Baltic states. He went to Estonia and basically said, our commitment to your security is ironclad. Vladimir Putin, don't even think about trying in Eastern Europe what you've been doing in Ukraine. But what that simply reflects is exactly what Josh said, right, that we are drawing the line, we're simply drawing it elsewhere.
And they're NATO allies. I mean, that's the important distinction, that we're drawing the line in our own alliance and not Ukraine, who's out of the alliance.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phone now and speak with J.D. in Southlake. Hi, J.D.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
20 years ago, Samuel P. Huntington wrote a book called The Clash of Civilizations, The Remaking of World Order. That book is as relevant today as it was 20 years ago. It should be mandatory reading for anybody going to college or anybody else that has an interest in the issue of what's going on in the Mideast. That being said, in the Mideast, in Islam, that is a civilization separate from Western civilization, and they do not like us or anybody else on the planet. And I think we're missing a wonderful opportunity to allow ISIS to do what it wants to do and allow the Islamic people to determine if they want to live in the 7th century or the 21st century.
Gentlemen, any comment?
Well, I think that The Clash of Civilizations is a very interesting book for a lot of reasons, but I don't know how much it applies to this case, because what you're seeing is mostly intra-civilizational violence and turmoil. So whatever you think of Huntington's work, I don't know that this is a great example of it in practice.
I would also simply say that I don't think ISIS is a particularly great example of self-determination. ISIS has shown itself to be incredibly brutal towards many of the people that it nominally represents in Iraq and Syria. And so my guess is that there are lots and lots of people in the territory that ISIS controls that don't want to live in the 7th century.
We're speaking this hour with Hal Brands, Assistant Professor of Public Policy and History at Duke University and author of What Good is Grand Strategy, and with Joshua Rovner, John G. Tower, Distinguished Professor of International Politics and National Security at SMU. This evening at SMU, there will be a panel discussion that both my guests are taking part in. It's called After Al-Qaeda, The Future of American Grand Strategy. If you want to jump in on this conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can learn how to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at an information session on October 8th, now offering concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Joshua Rovner, John G. Tower, Distinguished Professor of International Politics and National Security at SMU, and with Hal Brands, Assistant Professor of Public Policy and History at Duke and author of What Good is Grand Strategy? Power and Purpose in American Statecraft from Harry S. Truman to George W. Bush. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Surely to you, gentlemen, this seems very obvious, but can you talk about some of the factors that have convinced President Obama and members of his administration that an Asia focus really is critical moving into the future?
I think that there's two big things going on. One is historical. Historically, the rise of new great powers has been a moment of intense international controversy. Whenever a new great power rises and an old great power starts to decline, you can have some very bad outcomes. You have the potential for very catastrophic conflicts. So because of historical precedent, we're understandably looking at China. And at the same time, interestingly, Chinese leaders are always trying to reassure us that they're going to be a different kind of rising power. They're not going to resemble something like Imperial Germany or Imperial Japan, who are very hostile and very aggressive. They say, hey, we're a different kind of rising great power.
Excuse me for interrupting. Meaning interested in economic growth and dominance as opposed to military might.
What they say is a peaceful rise. Right? We want to be part of the global community. We want our rightful place at the table, but we want to be involved in international institutions and trade and so forth. This is going to be a peaceful rise. Some American leaders probably don't buy that or don't buy it completely or are skeptical enough where they're waiting to see and waiting somewhat warily. And the other major reason beyond the historical background is simply the numbers involved. Right? You look at the amount of trade, the amount of financial flows, the amount of energy that's flowing around East Asia right now. It's staggering. And it more or less dwarfs any other region on the planet. So American leaders are obviously going to be paying close attention to the politics of that region.
Yeah, just to add to that, since the end of the Cold War, one of the foremost principles of American grand strategy or American foreign policy has been that we do not want to see the emergence of what we would call a peer challenger. This is a country that could rival the United States for global influence, a country that could become as powerful or as dangerous, say, as the Cold War era Soviet Union. This has been basically a mainstay of American strategy documents going back to the very early 1990s. And so if you're looking out on the horizon and you're thinking which countries are most likely to fit this bill over the next 50 years, there's really only one candidate, and that's China. And so that explains a lot of what the Obama administration has been doing. They're looking down the road and thinking this could potentially be a very serious problem for American interests and American security. We don't know that it's going to be a problem. We don't know what U.S.-China relations are going to look like 40 or 50 years hence, but it's certainly an area that we want to pay more attention to.
How much is China talking about pressing sort of long-standing territorial claims that it has spoken about in places like Japan and Vietnam?
China has become much more assertive really in the last 5 years, starting in about 2009. They've become much more assertive about staking, especially maritime claims, and pushing out their claims about how much of the water they own. Most legal observers take issue with Chinese claims about how much water they actually own. My view on this is China is doing what great powers usually do when they start to get more powerful. They start to want to push out and expand their influence. Chinese behavior for the last 5 years, even longer than that, has been consistent with a lot of great powers, including the United States historically, that it starts to want to exert more influence on the region around it and to the extent it can, more control.
What's been striking about Chinese behavior since about 2009, 2010, is how much it seems to contrast with what we saw from China over the decade prior. And so during the late 1990s and through most of the early part of the first decade of this century, China had embarked on what was generally called sort of a charm offensive in Southeast Asia and East Asia more generally, trying to reassure its neighbors that it was committed to a peaceful rise, trying to build trade and diplomatic ties with them. What they've done in the past 5 years, as Josh said, has been to push much more assertively on the territorial claims part, and to really become more sort of as well in the ways that they've begun to project military power in the region. Now, the tricky part is that for China, this may actually be counterproductive. One of the things they've accomplished in doing this is refocusing U.S. attention on East Asia. One of the things they've accomplished is re-solidifying some of America's alliances to a greater degree than they had been before. They've succeeded in pushing countries like Vietnam to consider much closer ties with the United States. And so China would absolutely like to expand its influence in East Asia, I think, but they run a very real risk that their own assertive behavior will produce blowback.
And just to add one more point to that, I agree with everything Hal said. Just to add one more point to that, what they're doing might be working at cross purposes. So on the one hand, China still wants to project this image of a peaceful rise, mostly involved in international economics and institutions. And on the other hand, to pursue these new maritime claims, they're stoking a lot of nationalism, right? So they're stoking a lot of traditional Chinese nationalism. And they're also inadvertently stoking a lot of nationalism in Japan and elsewhere. And whenever you have countries who are really flush with nationalism, you could have a recipe for a very serious confrontation.
Is there sufficient expertise, sufficient capacity within the Department of State currently to accommodate a pivot to China in a way that, you know, after 9/11, we found that there were some gaps in our ability to fully understand the situation in the Middle East? There were questions about language and culture that, we didn't comprehend as well as we might have liked to.
I think this is a recurring problem you face when you have a truly global interests or truly global activities, as the United States does. There's simply not the capacity in the Department of State or any other institution in the U.S. government to have all the expertise you would want on every culture and country at a given time. And so when our attention pivots, as it did after 9/11, you will often see that there's a deficiency and then some pretty significant, some pretty intense efforts to ramp up. And so in the decade after 9/11, Arabic speakers were in high demand in the United States. My guess is that we're seeing another swing in that swing towards looking for East Asian expertise these days. I think we are constantly going to have this problem as long as we define our interests as broadly as we do.
I think that one thing that grand strategy does, and Hal brings this out really well in his book, one thing that grand strategy does is it forces you to prioritize, right? It forces you to make decisions about what areas of the world you really, really care about and what ones you're willing to some degree, neglect, right? In the early Cold War, it became clear that the Soviet Union was going to be the principal adversary. And the United States government invested a huge amount of time and resources into building expertise in the Soviet Union, in the language, the culture, the economy, and the politics of that place. It might be where a decision to really truly rebalance to Asia will involve a similar kind of effort to aggressively improve our knowledge of East Asia. I think that because our interests are so much more spread out now than they were then, that it's not going to be as complete a focus, but I wouldn't be surprised if we made some sort of effort along those lines.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Ryan in Dallas. Hi, Ryan.
Hello. I had a quick question. So I remember during Obama's reelection, there was a period where a conversation was overheard, I believe, between him and Vladimir Putin, and he was saying something about give me more time and I can do something about the missile shield program. He said he needed more flexibility. How could these two gentlemen go from that type of relationship to where we are now with them going kind of tit for tat and causing all the chaos? What happened? Did something develop? Were there a series of incidences that brought them to this state?
Thanks for your call.
Just to clarify, that conversation was between President Obama and Dmitry Medvedev, who was then the Russian president. He was the president of Russia, sort of between Putin's various terms in office. The Obama administration came to office in 2009 promoting the idea of a reset in U.S.-Russia relations, the idea being that the relationship had deteriorated from sort of its heights in the 1990s and that both sides needed to make a concerted effort to deal with the other on a fair footing, to accommodate each other's interests, and that cooperation was possible between the two governments. And to be fair, this approach actually did produce some pretty significant results. If you look at Iran sanctions, for instance, there was much greater U.S.-Russian cooperation during the 2009, 2010, 2011 period than there had been before. I think the policy was perhaps based on a misunderstanding of how much cooperation was possible, of how seriously Russia interpreted the turn toward the West of some of the countries in its what they call the near abroad. And so what I think you've seen over the past couple of years is not really a dramatic shift in the relationship as the culmination of a lot of tensions that have been building over the past few years and even going back to the 1990s.
Yeah, we put a lot of stock into personal relationships. Obviously, we're very interested in individual leaders and how they get along and why they sometimes can't get along. But I think the problem between the United States and Russia really isn't about the personal relationship between President Obama and President Putin. It's about fundamental political differences, right? From the U.S. point of view, Russia is aggressively pushing into Ukraine, trying to reshape the post-Cold War order, trying to rewrite borders, and that's totally unacceptable. From the Russian point of view, the United States is trying to push up against its border. It's trying to push NATO into its traditional sphere of influence, and that's unacceptable. So what I think you're seeing is just the culmination of a breakdown because of these different political interests, more so than any personal personal breakdowns.
No sooner did you say that, Josh, than I want to ask you about Iran and whether there is a difference or we can expect some kind of difference in terms of relationships with Rouhani at the helm.
Well, people certainly hope so, right? That Rouhani is a different character than Ahmadinejad was, and that he'd be more amenable to negotiations. The question in Iran is, how much does Rouhani actually control? And understanding Iranian politics is incredibly difficult. And people spend their whole careers trying to unpack what's going on in Tehran and see who's really in charge. I see the negotiations over Iran's nuclear program seem to be driven, at least from my interpretation, as being based on fundamental political differences and less so about the personality of the guy in charge.
Yeah, I would simply add to that we tend to focus on who is the president of Iran as being the key decision maker, but all the evidence points to the fact that the key decision maker is actually the supreme leader. Mm-hmm. And the president is a key decision maker, but not ultimately the most influential one. One of the interesting things we've seen over the past couple of years is that it's looked more and more likely at times that we are going to get some sort of deal, some sort of permanent or semi-permanent deal between the United States and its diplomatic partners and then Iran on the other hand. Essentially to achieve some sort of settlement of the Iranian nuclear program. That's been driven, I think, in part by the fact that economic sanctions against Iran have really had some bite. Now, the problem is that there is still quite a bit of difference between the Western position and then Iran's position in the negotiations, and I just don't think we know yet how that's going to shake out over the next 6 months or a year.
Yeah, Iran's position and our position actually have been quite consistent over the last dozen years, right? The United States would like to see an end of enrichment of uranium, no nuclear activities whatsoever if we could take them out of the equation. And Iran has been steadfast about its right to what it says is enrich uranium for peaceful energy purposes, right? And it feels totally justified in this position, no matter who seems to be in charge at any given moment.
I would simply add to that we're not the only ones with political problems in dealing with foreign policy. So the Iranian leadership has for so long portrayed uranium enrichment as an inalienable right of the Iranian people that to accept some pretty significant curbs on their ability to enrich is going to be seen as a pretty significant retreat. And so that simply adds to the complexity and the difficulty of getting a deal.
Little over 2 years left in the Obama administration. To what extent does any one administration's grand strategy necessarily inform what the one to follow will do?
I think there's a long pattern in American politics of an administration coming to power saying that the last administration did everything wrong and that we're going to do everything differently. You can see this with the Bush to Clinton transition in 1992, 1993. You can see that with the Clinton to Bush transition in 2000, 2001, and so on and so forth. And so every administration comes in to some extent thinking that they can reinvent the wheel, right? That they can operate from an entirely different playbook. And one of the things they realize when they come into office is that there was a reason why the last administration was doing the things that it did, either because the other options looked so bad or because the course of action the administration was pursuing wasn't all that stupid to begin with. And so there absolutely is room for personal and executive choice in American foreign policy, and different presidents do make different decisions. So I'm not saying that everything is completely predetermined, but I think there's more continuity in American grand strategy over the past 60 or 70 years, or even going farther back than that, than we often think.
I think that there's a lot of continuity. I think since the end of the Cold War, I think there's been a durable consensus in Washington, Democratic and Republican, that the world will be safer the more that it looks like us. So we've tried very hard to expand democracy and free markets and American-style institutions, and that has cost us a great deal.
Joshua Rovner is John G. Tower Distinguished Professor of International Politics and National Security at SMU. Hal Brands is Assistant Professor of Public Policy and History at Duke University and author of What Good is Grand Strategy? Power and Purpose in American Statecraft from Harry S. Truman to George W. Bush. Gentlemen, it's been great to have both of you here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and by Lindsay Connect and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help on the phones today from Christina Martinez. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.